Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And we're joined once again by Nick Dimbleby.
Hello.
Back for round two. You know you're an important guest when you get a second episode.
I know. And it's sat here for a whole week on the sun and sofa.
I know, yeah.
Oh, that's it. I'm taking residence now.
Camping out on its dusty goodness. So if you tuned in last week, you will have heard Nick's story, his account of the his trip to the Himalayas or the Himalayas in his reasonably recently acquired 1.8 Freelander. And he's back to talk about more Land Rover goodness. We're sort of just going to have a general chat and see what we're going to talk about. Nick's career, we're going to talk about what he's got coming up, we're going to touch on lots of different things in this, so stay tuned. But first of all, I guess we'll kick off with, I would imagine 99.9% of people listening to this podcast know exactly who you are, and so they should. But where did it all begin for you? Where did your career start with Land Rovers in general?
I suppose it started back in the late 1980s when I was quite young. So I grew up in Somerset, so was surrounded by Land Rovers and sort of off-roading opportunities. So I loved cars, I loved photography, and sort of aged 11, 12, picked up a camera and sort of started taking pictures. So it's, I guess, inevitable that I ended up taking pictures of Land Rovers. So I suppose it started as a way of getting my pictures in print. I wrote a book called Range Rover Conversions.
Okay.
Which was published by Haynes Publishing in late 1987, when I was 13. I wrote it when I was quite young.
Very young.
But at the time, it didn't really seem like it. It was just one of those things. I was just completely obsessed with Range Rovers, and as a nerdy teenager, you get focused on one thing. And, you know, back in those days, there was no internet to distract you. There was no sort of gaming to distract you. You know, there's only three channels on the TV, or four channels, I think, by then. But
Possibly Channel 4.
So, yeah, Channel 4, yeah, in the early 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it was a different world. There wasn't as much entertainment going on. So, how do you find something to do? Well, you just sort of read lots of books and end up sort of writing one. So, I was fortunate enough to get it published. That was the start of my career.
So how did you say you managed to get that first book published? How did you go about getting that published as a then quite young teenager?
Yeah, well, my dad had published a couple of books, so I sort of felt like it was fairly straightforward to get a book published, because I'd seen my dad do it. I was like, well, if dad can do it, then I'll say,
well, aunt's didn't there thinking, how on earth do you go about doing that?
So, yeah, so that I think probably sort of spurred me on a bit. And then it was before, I hadn't got a computer at that point, so it was all done on a typewriter.
Right.
So obviously, because my writing was so appalling, still is. So, it was all sort of typewritten out. So, and I wrote letters to these manufacturers, to people like Wood & Pickett, Glenfroom, Townley Cross Country Vehicles, all these sort of old companies that are long since gone that were doing these amazing Range Rover conversions back in the day. Wrote a letter on a typewriter, didn't obviously say how old I was,
and
these people wrote back and said, yeah, of course we'd like to help do a book, here's some information, some photographs. And I sort of put it together as a bit of a scrapbook and then passed this on to Haynes Publishing, that were in Somerset, so they were actually a local publisher to us. It was published. I mean, I look at it now and it's pretty poor.
What an accomplishment though, at 13 years old, getting a book published on a subject that you're clearly, you know, massively passionate about. It's must have been a real boost in confidence back then.
Yeah, I guess. And then, yeah, so then that was, I guess, early days of Land Rover Owner magazine.
Yes.
It started, I think, in the same year, I think, 87, I think, with the first issue, of Land
Richard
Rover.
Richard Howe Thomas.
Yeah. Richard Howe Thomas, yeah. Richard Green and John Cornwall, three guys basically making a magazine in a shed. It was literally produced in their shed.
Fantastic.
Back in the day. Very independent publication. You know, the really the first Land Rover magazine. There was Off-Road and Four-Wheel Drive was the other magazine that was around
David Bowie launch.
David Bowie, back in the early 80s. Yeah, Overlander magazine.
According to David, though, other people, he probably doesn't listen to the, listen to the podcast, but we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him, because he was the he was the launch of all magazines around Land Rovers and off-roading.
Well, you could argue that. I mean, it's true. Overlander magazine was the first. You know, there was the club mags, the all-wheel drive club mags and things like that.
That's probably still going, isn't it? The club mag is a magazine format.
He's regaled me with tales when I've been to visit him in previous years of him pasting everything out on his kitchen table to get it all ready to go. It's just that
it was pre-desktop publishing. There was no computers or, you know, there was none of that layout stuff. It was all done with, you know, bits of paper cutting out. And that was, you know, literally, it was called layout because you laid it out on a table.
Yeah, it's just amazing, isn't it?
It's still called layout now, isn't it?
Yeah. But
no one really...
You never lay it out. You lay it out on the computer.
Yeah.
We've got it so easy, Martin. I don't know why you moan so much.
Well, I can't take credit for laying out the magazine. I collate all the good stuff that goes into it. But our illustrious art director, Sam, he's the guy that takes care of making the magazine look as good as it does.
To be fair, he does do
there's a real
job.
Skill in it.
That's
real.
Sure, yeah,
it is. Yeah, he doesn't do it at his kitchen table. Well, on his kitchen table. He might sit at his kitchen table at his computer.
But it was very different. I mean, it was all on film as well. So it was all pre-digital photography. So everything was shot on film. It's a very different world. But that's where it all started for me. So it started with Land Rover owner. And I was still at school, but, you know, absolutely passionate about Land Rovers, and I like to write, and I like to go and take pictures of Land Rovers. So that's what I did. And luckily my parents, it's before I could drive even, my parents would actually take me to places to go and photograph the cars, and would do a story. So it'd be things like, working Land Rovers. So I went to photograph the AA with their... What was the Land Rover band down in Exmoor, which was near where I lived? We did stuff with National Grid, with electricity Land Rovers, you know, the ones with the cherry pickers, and obviously those are the recent issue. That was photographing it when it was, you know, still in service. Not that particular car, but, you know, the similar ones. That's where it all started. And then, sort of carried on working for Land Rover owner, went to college, went to uni, obviously working for the magazine throughout. And then I left uni in late 95 and basically started my career as a full-time photographer. And my big break, if you like, was being on Camel Trophy in 1996. That was the start of big stuff. So that was the start of my career proper. And it's been downhill ever since.
And now you're here.
I'm here, that's it. I've now reached the pinnacle. It's time to retire.
You've not reached the bottom quite yet. So 1996 comes around, Camel Trophy.
Yes.
Did Land Rover just pick up the phone and say, you're the sort of guy for us?
Well, there's another story there as well. This is one of these things. This podcast could go on for several hours.
Part three and part four.
Everyone's not falling asleep. If you're having trouble sleeping, maybe this is what you need. But in 96, so back to LRO, I actually had a place on Camel Trophy through the magazine. So they were offered a place, and back then it wasn't, I mean, the event was 3 weeks. So you were the embedded journalist and you were in that vehicle on the event for 3 weeks, which, you know, not many people can do that really as a professional journalist, because obviously it's a lot of time to be out of the office. But obviously as a freelancer starting in your career, it's perfect because you can do it. So, but then there's a twist in that a friend of mine, Don Marder, was working at the boat show on a stand, and he got to meet a chap called Lee Farrant, who was the director of photographic for Camel Trophy. And he said, oh, you need to speak to my friend Nick. He's a photographer and he photographs Land Rovers. He'd be perfect for you. And he's like, oh, well, yeah, great. Here's my card. Get him to give me a call. So I gave him a call. And again, strange twist of fate. He actually lived about sort of 6-7 streets away where I was living in London at the time. And so we met up at the pub, and he said, look, you know, I've I've already got my team sorted for Camel Trophy this year, but you know, I've looked at your stuff, it looks good. Would you be up for doing a deal where I'll give you film and I'll get it processed on site, but the deal is we get to use any of your pictures, but everything else you get to take away and keep. So that's the deal he did. You know, basically, I got all my film paid for on the event, which obviously was a big deal back in the day, because it was, you know, several, it was about, I think about 10 or 15 pounds a roll to, wow. to, was, to really? So, yeah, even back then, it was a lot of money. So, so basically all the film and stuff was taken care of. And in the end, I think I ended up getting quite a large proportion of the edit were my pictures. So, come the next year in 97, Lee said, yeah, we'd like you to come and join the team. And so I was one of the official photographers for 97, 98, and then 2000, which was the last event.
Wow.
Where was the last one again?
In Fiji, Tonga and Samoa.
Okay.
But it was in boats.
Yeah.
So it was Land Rover's last event was 98, but the last Camel Trophy was 2000, which was, in ribs. So very, very different event.
So this is like this whole career has just taken you completely around the world. Like,
yes,
Philandrovi. It's been what a fantastic.
I mean, it wasn't designed that way, but it's one of those things that working for a brand like Land Rover, because they obviously, it's very much an adventure brand that travels the world. So they need pictures of the vehicles being photographed around the world. So I've been lucky enough to. I think I've been to about 88 countries now.
Have you?
Wow,
that's amazing.
Yeah, I've done. I mean, with Land Rover, I've done 3 pretty serious overland trips. So I did the first one was in 1998 with the Discovery 2 as part of the launch. They did a round the world trip.
Yeah.
So I did the first leg, which was London to Calcutta, which was 25 days from basically London to India overland. We went through Turkey, well, obviously all through Eastern Europe, across Turkey, across Iran, and into Pakistan, across northern Pakistan, near the Afghan border, and then into India. So, you couldn't do that trip now, obviously, because tensions. And then I did another big trip was Norway to Jordan, again with Discovery 2, actually. That was the facelift.
Okay.
And that was, again, a trip you couldn't do. We went all the way through Eastern Europe and then into Syria. Drove through Damascus and then into Jordan and then down through Jordan down to the Red Sea. So that rally was called the Midnight Sun to Red Sea. That was in 2002. And then the last sort of really big overland trip was with the Range Rover Hybrid.
Yes.
2013. You remember there was
absolutely
a feature that Gary did in Land Rover Monthly, and that was 54 days, and that was again London to Birmingham to India to Mumbai.
The Silk Trail
following the route of the old Silk Trail. Yeah, so we went again across Eastern Europe into the stands, and then across Kyrgyzstan into northern China, all the way down the western side of China, into Nepal, and then Nepal into India. So amazing trip, really.
It's a long old time to be inside a vehicle, isn't it?
A long time to be inside a vehicle. But again, you know, one of the things that's been fantastic about my career is the people I've met. There's, generally speaking, Land Rover people are good people.
And absolutely.
Amazing times with you know, people that work for Land Rover or associated with Land Rover, or you know, that have worked with Camel Trophy, you know, amazing people that have had some amazing times with. So I feel very, very fortunate to have the career and the life that I have.
Well, we're absolutely chuffed to have you on board as a contributor for LRM as well. It's fantastic, the stories.
Well, I've been working with LRM since the beginning as well.
Back in 98.
I think the first cover is my cover. I think the shot of the Defender on the first issue. I think it is.
We did a retrospective, didn't we?
Yeah,
like a flick through the first ever issue of Land Rover Monthly on the podcast. So if you've not already listened to that, go back through the catalogue and have a listen. Really, really good, and it's amazing to see the sort of content that was being focused on back then and the way things have changed. Really cool sort of period adverts for accessories back then as well.
All shot on film as well. All those pictures that were there were all shot on film. back in 98, so not that long ago. But,
no, not really. Not,
but yeah. Their digital photography was only just starting at that point. I think my first digital camera, we used them on Camel Trophy in 1998 and 2000, and then the first digital camera that I got was in 2001.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, real.
So 20, I guess 25 years.
To 25 years.
Quarter
yeah.
of a century ago.
Yeah, and it yeah. was. It was again. It was about another 2 or 3 years that the quality became good enough to be used in magazines, because the early digital cameras weren't that great. You know, you could, if you actually look at back at issues back then, the colours are a little bit weird, a little bit sort of not that great. So we were shooting quite often in tandem. So we were shooting film and digital at the same time.
Oh, right. Okay.
So there's a period of G4 Challenge on 2003. We shot half and half. So it was half digital, half film. So you shot digital for online for right. stuff that was live.
Over.
And then post-event, there was a film edit that was produced that was for all the sort of the brochures and the sort of posters and all the stuff where you wanted the high quality images.
Wow.
With regards to like cameras then, are cameras at the peak now? Do you think they can get any better?
No, I think you're right. It's definitely, they've got to the point now where in terms of image quality, they're never going to get any better.
Right.
So how are they going to sell new equipment then, if you get to that
good
point?
Good question. The generally, advancement? Generally speed,
it's a bit like that with cars,
operation,
isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's very much like that.
There'll be, well, I mean, I'm not trying to predict where cameras are going to go, but I suspect there'll be things like AI composition. I mean, again, your mobile phone probably has a better camera than, you know, your cameras that we were using yeah. sort of 10 years ago. And again, it's just the quality of the image in terms of, it'll be easier to get a nice quality image, you know, in terms of the difficult things of having a bright sky and a dark foreground, you know, things like that, where in the past it would have been impossible to capture that. So effectively what you see with your eye, the camera will capture. Because if you imagine when you take a picture without any processing, you're never going to be able to match the clarity that you can see with your with the naked eye. So that's that's probably where it's going to go, isn't it? In terms of, it'll be, you know, almost again like the old Google glasses. You look at it, and then that'll be the picture.
You talking of image quality and stuff like that. I can imagine jumping back to Camel Trophy. That was a real challenge to keep everything together and running smoothly in those kind of conditions. I bet that was a real challenge in itself, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, in fact, I think if you may have seen, I wrote a book about Camel Trophy. One of the chapters is about that, the way that photography and the video and side of things was done. And it was great, actually, looking back as the researcher part of that book, because it was all on film. So you had to bring those films into the jungle, keep them cool, keep them dry. And then obviously, you know, in the case of the official photographers, there would be a helicopter pickup every couple of days where they would literally, the helicopter would fly into a prearranged spot in the jungle, pick up all the film that would be then flown back to the event headquarters, where there was a lab set up. Again, that lab would have been brought from London. And they had film, as in transparency and negative film. That would be then processed, scanned, looked at, edited, and then they would have produced, I think the later years, it was on CD. So it was like a photo CD with images on. But prior to that, it was dupes. So they would have a duplication camera where you literally photographed the original transparency to produce a duplicate, and then you could make multiple duplicates, and then all the media that were there would take away a pack of duplicate pictures, which then would be scanned for the magazines.
Crikey. What a
massive operation.
And a degree of responsibility.
Well, massive,
Something goes wrong. Like now, you can look on the screen, can't you? See
exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we never knew. I mean, you imagine you did 3 weeks worth of event in the jungle. You had no idea what you'd shot for the entire time. You literally were.
That's crazy.
You'd be taking these pictures and you'd
hoping send them off. That nothing's gone wrong.
Yeah, and you would get feedback, and in fact, the photo editor that was there, he would send back notes, handwritten notes, or there'd be radio messages about, you know, could you get more shots of the French team, because we haven't got many shots of them, or, you know, could you shoot more stuff that shows the car, or, you know, there'd be lots of little instructions. And there was also a bit of a Premier League on who was getting the most shots on the edits.
Right.
There was a team of about four photographers that were doing official photography for the event. And we'd have a little friendly, competitive, you know, who is getting the most shots into the main edit. So, So as the event would progress, you'd be like, you know, oh yeah, you haven't done very well this week. This is, you know, you need to up your game. So
right, was, keep the edge.
I suppose each photographer has their own style, don't they?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
You know, and you mix it up a bit, don't you, for sort of variety, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, you're producing, and that's one of the things as a professional photographer, yeah, you have to shoot images that are useful. So in other words, I mean, you're talking about Sam and doing the layout for the magazine. So when you're photographing or shooting for print or shooting for online, you have to think about the way the image is framed. So you might have more space on the top of the picture for a headline or for text.
Oh, yes, of course. So you cover, sort of, cover car, you'd leave more space for...
Exactly. So you're sort of thinking about the... So you're not only making the image look nice, you're also trying to think about where that image might be used and how it will be used. So that's very much a part of the professional photographer's sort of compositional plan, if you like, of how they take a picture.
Sort of magazine craft, which is something that, you know, people...
And again, you,
this Instagram now, you know, we've talked about Instagram in the last week's episode, you know, it's almost throwaway, isn't it? You know, people just take a picture and
you might think about how, you know, how that format fits the phone, for example. So, you know, shooting vertical pictures or, you know, an image that is slightly off center to allow for, you know, your eye goes to that because it's in the center of the screen, or, you know, or maybe it's a bit of a challenging image because it's slightly off and then that makes you look at it twice. You know, when you've got a lot of images, you know, you, as you say, people are scrolling through.
You've got
through.
So split seconds for them to
exactly. So you need an image that is resting. You know, and again, we were talking obviously about the yellow Freelander.
Yes.
So one of the things that is, you know, I think working for Camel Trophy G4 Challenge, they're bright coloured cars, and the reason they're bright coloured cars because they stand out. You know, you want that sort of. That image that catches your eye amongst a sea of other images, which is why, you know, bright colour cars are great for sort of social media and, you know, getting people to look at what you're, you know, to stop scrolling.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah.
And yet you look at modern cars now, including Land Rover.
50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, it's all grey, blacks and... Yeah, they're boring, quite bland, aren't they? We're a nation in the UK particularly, boring coloured cars.
I think it's coming out the other side of that, though. I think for a long time, you're right, it was white, black, grey, resale colours that manufacturers would kind of push you into buying because they knew when they got it back at the end of the PCP, they could sell it easily. But now, where even like you look out on the road, there's a lot more vibrant colours out there. And I think, again, I'll bang on about this till the cows come home, Land Rover's launch colours are the best colours of the that model span generally.
Yeah.
So I always get a bit excited when I see like a Kalima Lime or a Tambora Flame.
Yeah, well, that was because it was very much an era, wasn't it? That time when they would always do a launch colour.
Yeah.
Tambora Flame, Kalima Lime, exactly two good cases in point.
Barley Blue on the facelift.
Barley Blue.
On the Disto exactly. 4, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. These are all vehicles that I photographed back in the day as well. You're taking me back through my archive.
That's the golden era for me, really, was when, mind you, I say that, I almost fell over when I saw an Octa in Sargasso Blue. Oh,
yes.
Yeah, what a colour.
That's a cracking colour.
That's a colour you could dive into, that is. Oh.
Just bought your dream classic Land Rover? Whether it's an ex-MOD or a lovingly restored Defender, you'll need insurance that caters to the unique needs of classic 4x4s. Our loyal sponsor, specialist insurance broker Adrian Flux, has been providing Land Rover owners with tailored classic car insurance for decades. Their policies can include agreed value cover and limited mileage policies. Just search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
God,
you were almost going to go and like sell your house.
I was going to go, yeah, just mortgage up an Octa so I can have that colour.
Mortgage an Octa.
Yeah.
Live in an Octa.
Yeah, just
live
incredible.
In the roof tent on the roof.
Yeah, they're still doing it. But those, for me, those iconic, really, really cool vibrant colours. And you look at them on the swatch in the showroom and you think, no one's going to order that. And when they do, you think, wow, that's
glad
so
someone's
good.
Ordered that. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really smart. But
so going back to the 1990s then, mm-hmm. when I was peak buying Land Rover, I used to buy all the Land Rover magazines.
Yes.
Obsessing over it.
There was multiple.
There was four,
wasn't there, at one
four
point?
Magazines, yeah, and they used to, yeah. You know, and they used to be like 250-odd pages big, didn't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
And a lot of content to get through in a month when you were buying four magazines.
Yeah, I bet. What did you do?
Well, I had no internet.
You
weren't distracted by all this junk that's online, really.
True.
A lot of it is junk, isn't it? TEW.
Yes, let's talk about that. I was going to segue beautifully into the discovery and then back into TEW, but I'm glad you've brought it up.
I have to be
straight away.
I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask about TEW.
Well, I've had TEW since late '97, so that's when I first got TEW.
For those listeners who might not be aware of what TEW is, I mean, Steve and I obviously lose our minds over it whenever we see it anywhere, but what is TEW and why is it so iconic?
Okay, so TEW or TEW is my 100-inch Defender. So it's a Defender, but it's not a 90, it's not a 110, it's a 100. So it's, it was originally a project vehicle for 4x4 magazine. So going back to 80s magazines, so 4x4 was one of the... the general mark off-road magazines back in the 80s.
Yeah.
The editor at the time, a chap called Russell Fisher, had a Lada Niva, which he replaced with a Range Rover, a 1978 two-door Range Rover, registration TEW78X. So he then proceeded to destroy that car, off-roading it on green lanes around Northamptonshire and where he's living, basically sort of worked out soon that a Range Rover with its slightly longer overhangs and bigger body is not as good a vehicle to be taking seriously off road if you don't want to end up with lots of body damage. So decided that it would be a good idea to change it into a Land Rover. Now, of course, if you remember, in 1987, that was 4 years after the first coil sprung Land Rover, the 110. Obviously the 90 was out the following year, in 84. Yeah. And obviously 87, 3 years later, if you wanted a coil sprung Land Rover, it was really expensive because the cars were only 3 years old. Yeah. So if you were on a budget and you wanted a coil sprung Land Rover, the only way you could do it was you would buy what was then a 15-year-old Range Rover. That
of course, yeah.
Was rusty as hell.
There was body no choice. Was,
no, yeah. The body was rusty, knackered, worth nothing.
Already at 15 years old.
Exactly.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, because it was in 1985, an early Range Rover Suffix A. And that's, I mean, obviously that's one of the things that now we look at, you know, Suffix A's at Range Rovers that are, you know, worth a fortune. And you can't even imagine that someone would chop one up.
Yeah.
But obviously...
But they did.
But they did, because they were just old, cheap Range Rovers.
My three-door Range Rover never went on to live another...
Yeah, exactly. Because they were rusty, knackered, throwaway cars. Mm. Yeah, exactly. You know, they were old. So that was, if you wanted a coil sprung Land Rover cheaply, then the best way to do it was to buy an old Range Rover and put a Land Rover body on top, which is exactly what Russell Fisher did back in 87 as a project vehicle. So basically a magazine, a sort of a how-to, if you like. This was a sort of an inspirational vehicle for readers to, you know, they wanted their own coil sprung vehicle. Well, this is how you do it. And it was built by a chap called Pete Rowe, who lived down in Devon. He was still very much a part of the all-wheel drive club scene. Pete's amazing sort of mechanic. He basically built the car using a mixture of this original Range Rover TEW, and then also it was a series 2 back end, a Defender, it was a 110 left-hand drive ex-military bulkhead,
right,
that they managed to get from, I don't know, I think it was Peter Hobson, I think it was at the time. And it was a military vehicle that had been destroyed and the bulkhead was existing. So it had a 110 bulkhead, 110 wings, I think it was a stage 1 bonnet. Anyway, it was a real bitzer. And it was a project vehicle used throughout the late 80s, early 90s by 4x4 magazine. Then it became a project vehicle for International Off-Roader.
Yes.
So again, a magazine that is now no longer with us, but at the time was edited by a chap called Colin Dawson. So Colin Dawson had TW at that point. And again, it went through another iteration of basically transforming itself into what was then known as the VOD, the Vehicle of Doom. And it had a huge, I think there were 35-inch tyres on it, and winch, roll cage, ARB lockers front and rear. It was a real 3.5
proper thing.
Yeah, exactly. It was a real tool.
I remember it in the early days. Yeah.
And, 900 tyres on it.
Exactly, that's it. Yeah, that's XCLs.
Did it have XCLs on it?
And not when I had it, no. So it was...
900 XCLs.
It was 900 XCLs for a time, back in, I think, the mid-90s.
Heavens
yeah.
above. It's the stuff dreams are made of. I'm going to have a lie down after this.
So I've got photographs of this. I'll show you some pictures.
Oh, yes.
What we'll do, hopefully, Nick, if you're happy to do it, we'll put a picture up when we promote this on social, and we can have a look at that. You have to see it really to understand what this vehicle is all about.
Well, it's Trigger's broom, really, because it was. So when I got it in '98, it was pretty tired,
right?
And it was one of those things where. So I think the engine was the first thing that I changed. So it was a carbureted, single carburetor. Actually, it was a Holley carb. That never really worked properly.
Right.
The original four-speed LT 95 Range Rover gearbox with the integrated transfer box. So I changed that. That went. That got chucked away, and I ended up with a 3.9, and then the five-speed Santana box, which is actually still the same engine and gearbox that's in the car today.
Right.
So that ran that for a bit, and then. It got apparent that the chassis was looking a little bit worse for wear, and so it was rebuilt by Frogs Island 4x4.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 2001, I think it was. It went from being that sort of series mishmash with a split windscreen and Defender front. And I did a job where I got paid did a job with Land Rover Genuine Parts, where I got paid in parts.
Oh, brilliant.
So I got lots of really nice North American spec, NAS spec 90 parts. So the swing away rear door and the split doors, the rare as hen's teeth internal split door, the trim panel. With the little, So I've got that in there. That was, again, through Genuine Parts. It was rebuilt in 2001. I then spent the next 15 years off-roading it fairly hard, and by 2016 it was time for another rebuild.
I remember it having a rebuild. But what colour was it in the early?
So it was the colour that was the launch colour for the Discovery 2, called white gold. So it was goldy colour.
I remember that. Yeah, is it white now?
It's white now. It was this sort of goldy white, which actually it was. Was amazed to see when they launched the Works V8 convertible soft top.
Yes.
Land Rover Classic, their hero colour was pretty much the same colour that I painted mine back in 2001. So,
because that look that you went for in those days is exactly the look that's in vogue, as it were, now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I was well ahead of the game.
Quarter of a century ahead of the game.
But at the time, everyone was like, why have you painted it gold?
Why? But I remember those magazines. That was pinnacle, like the top.
Yeah, it was
aspirational.
It was great. It was a really, again, it shows the nature of the Defender, the fact you can take bits, cut them up, change them. But, at the end of the day, I always tried to keep it looking as factory, but with a twist. That was my look that I wanted to go for. So, basically that original incarnation in 2001, soft top. It was a grey soft top. With a 3.9 V8, lots of North American spec, 90 bits on it. And, it was a great, great car.
Basically, the car that Land Rover should have built. Themselves.
It's the car that a lot of people at home would have wanted to if they hadn't already built themselves. Yeah. It's because 100-inch wheelbase is probably the best all-round wheelbase. Big tyres, locking front and rear diffs. Still looks like a utility, like a square Land Rover in a traditional sense. It really is probably an amalgamation of the best bits of everything.
Well, it's that thing where, for me, it was like, what is the ultimate Defender for me, and that's what I've built. And then this is where in 2016, so this was where I had a moment coming back to what we were saying, you know, 2016 was obviously the last of the classic Defender produced at Solihull, and I had a choice. I was going to buy one of the last of the line. I wish I had now, but obviously only had limited resources. And I decided, rather than spend the money on buying a new Defender, I would spend the money on basically redoing mine again, but again completely new. So I bought a lot of new parts, a lot of new bits, and effectively it was built as a new car. So new axles, new transmission, and this was built by a chap called Ben Stowe.
Yes, Blackport.
Blackport, exactly. So, and in fact, Ben, when he I asked him to do the project, he said this for him was an absolute dream come true, because he had grown up basically reading the magazines as a teenager, you know, into his Land Rovers, and obviously saw the vehicle being built back in the day, and then now as a, you know, as a grown man, if you like, sort of with his own business, he was building it again and putting his own stamp on it. So so it's great.
Yeah,
it still has to be one of the coolest Land Rovers in the history of
100%. The most probably one of the most well known and the most, to use a horrible word, iconic through that.
Yeah, it's had a lot of lives, you know. It's been featured in a lot of magazines, done a lot of things. Yeah. So again, I feel very fortunate to be, you know, its custodian. So really, it's sort of, you know, who knows where it'll end up next.
Well, I'd love to see it in person.
My son's got dibs on it.
Has he? Yeah, so, I don't blame him.
So
how old is your son?
He's 20.
So does he drive Land Rovers?
So he doesn't drive Land Rovers, actually. No, he's got a Golf. So, but yeah,
maybe he's holding out for.
He's holding out. I think that's it. Exactly.
Fair play to him.
If you're going to start with Land Rover, start with the best.
Well, where do you go from there, though? You're at the top of the tree already. But so you mentioned. I mean, you turned up in your loyal Discovery 3.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Quite an unusual car in itself, really.
Yes, I must say, I do get attracted to some of the more unusual vehicles. But so Discovery 3, so I did the launch of Discovery 3, and I've always had a bit of a soft spot for them. They are amazing cars, as I'm
absolutely
sure, you know, everyone listening to this will know. Discovery 3 is, like, for me, one of the, you know, the ultimate in terms of, it's got everything going for it. You know, it's practical, it's reliable. If you get one that's been well looked after,
sure.
And the one that I've got is a great car. I bought it in October 2022 for the princely sum of £5,300. It had done 101,000 miles, but as we said before, the absolute clincher of the sale for me was when I went in the glove box and there was a big pile of seats and a fully stamped service book.
That's just like 1 month's ownership.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I wonder why there were so many receipts.
Yes, you can't beat a stack of history, can you, with a car?
But yeah, so it showed that, you know, the clutch had been done, and, you know, all the proper timing chains and stuff that needed to be done at the right time had been done. So that was a nice and reassuring. So so I bought it and then took it down to my local specialist, the H. Douglas, and then they basically went through it. I said, look, you know, I want this car to be reliable, it needs to be good, you know, have it for as long as you need it and do whatever needs to be done. So I did spend another few thousand getting all the stuff that needed to get done, but for me, I look at it as an investment.
They've all got something hidden, haven't they? You can buy the very best, and they all seem to have just something.
Yeah, I just,
they're not cheap cars to work.
They're not, no, but I think for me, it's so now, once I got it to that level, that, you know, that there's going to be no nasty surprises, and now, you know, I don't do a huge mileage in it. I think I've had it almost 3 years, and it's now done 129,000, so it's done 29,000 in 3 years. Obviously, I've got other cars as well, and also I'm abroad quite a lot, so I also don't drive it. You know, it gets parked at the airport.
Yeah, it's good, 200 miles a week on average. So.
Yeah, so it's you know, it gets used, and but again, you know, I get it serviced every year, and it doesn't really cost me a lot of money. It's you know, it's £900 a year, brakes, you know, all the usual bits and pieces, the consumables that you need, and that's my attitude, is just, you know, look after the car, look after you.
Absolutely. I still maintain, I know we dog the engines because, you know, for what they offer, for what they are, they're an absolute bargain.
Yes.
And there's so many now that are, you can still find good, well-looked-after ones. They're a bit more expensive than the real lower end of the market, but like you say, that it pays dividends down the line, exactly, when the stuff's been kept on top of and it hasn't built up, and then you're faced with an enormous bill.
Because it is, you know, if you don't look after things or don't take care of the servicing that needs to be done, then as you say, it does build up, and then all of a sudden it costs a fortune to put all the stuff that needed to be done put right, and the car's not going to be reliable. So
finding the right parts for your Land Rover or Range Rover shouldn't be an off-road challenge. At bnh4x4.com, we've built a smarter way to get you back on track. Our new website is now live, the simple, fast and reliable way to find the parts and accessories you need. Supplying quality parts for Defender 1983 to 2016, Discovery 1, 2, 3 and 4, Range Rover Sport 2005 to 2013, with Range Rover P38A and L322 coming soon. All parts are backed by expert knowledge, quick delivery and a 2-year quality guarantee. Visit bmh4x4.com, built by enthusiasts for enthusiasts.
Yours is a weird one, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Again, it's a 2005, so it's a relatively early one. 2.7 diesel, obviously, the TDV6.
Yeah.
But it's with the 6-speed manual gearbox, which I absolutely love. I really enjoy being able to change gears myself, and actually, it drives really, really well. It's a really nice thing to drive, just because it's not often that you drive a big 4x4 now with a manual gearbox.
No,
everything's
certainly
auto, and it actually works really well. But it's, yeah, manual. It's an S spec, so it's got cloth seats, but it's unusual that whoever spec'd it at the time, I'd love to meet the original owner, but obviously you can't find that out nowadays, unfortunately. But it was spec'd with cloth seats, 7 seats, heated seats front and rear. It's got the adaptive headlights, the swiveling headlights, the xenons. And also the full sunroof pack, so it's got the full glass roof, which is unusual for an S to have all that kit.
It's incredibly odd that someone would go for a base spec and then spec it up that high.
It's basically an HSE with cloth seats and manual gearbox.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, it's really odd.
I guess that's what they wanted. I think they were keen on manual gearbox and cloth seats, but they wanted all the toys, and also the way to do that is to order the S. Although it doesn't have sat nav, which actually is fine by me, because obviously I don't want a 20-year-old sat nav anyway.
Outdated, and they're not supported.
No, but what's brilliant is the little hole in the middle there is actually perfect size for my iPhone, so I can just literally slot my iPhone into that gap, and then I've got my, you know, Google Maps and everything else I need on the thing in the same space where the screen normally is.
Oh, so it's a, yeah, of course, being an S, it would have that cubby box.
That's a little cubby box,
exactly, got you. Yeah. I mean, as the owner of my Freelander 2's a 2007, and you just ignore the screen.
So many roads are, like, missing from those early maps.
Not only that, they're so clunky and laggy, and, oh, there's
that. Having said that, I remember when that car first came out, so 2004, I did the launch photography for it, and I remember one of the things that absolutely blew my mind was, you know, it's got the little schematic with the suspension where it shows where the wheels are, where the suspension is, and obviously where the wheels are pointing.
Yeah.
But that was mind-blowing back then. That's absolutely incredible that you would have a car that would show you where its wheels were.
The amount of tech in those.
It was.
Back to
terrain response. That was the first car with the... With the terrain response system, so where you had the
fantastic, the, you turn the dial,
mud into, ruts, rock crawl and sand mode,
up
and
on
that.
The dash and the little
I
do miss my D3. I love, they're such a fantastic car, and they're properly solid, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I say you get a good one, and I say touch wood, mine's been absolutely brilliant.
Of course, yours would be in a lower tax bracket as well.
Yeah,
it is. I'm not paying nearly £800 a year.
No, I think I pay £400 a year. I think
yes, half price.
Yeah, that's it.
There aren't that many 2005s around.
My friend Mike, who I go camping with a fair bit, has got his is an 05, and his is a manual, but it's a real, it's still very base. It's not, no sunroof, nothing like that, cloth.
Yeah.
And I think when you get rid of that, that'd be quite nice to have. But his is very, very leggy, and it needs a bit of work doing. Whereas, as we've already said, you keep on top of them, then you don't have that amalgamation of work that needs doing. Yeah. They're a big, heavy car. They're very complex, as we've touched on. So it's really important that you seek out the right one.
Just keep on top. Seek out the right one. Get the right car, ideally with a good history, and then just keep on top of it.
Definitely. It's really nice. Lovely thing to cruise about in.
It is. I drove here from home today. It's it's about 60-odd miles, but all on A roads. And, yeah, it's great. Just punts along. You got no problem with the potholes.
No. A few floods. There's a few of them about.
Just take them on. It's not a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
nightmare.
And even like when I was driving the other day in the dark, you know, the headlights with the adaptive headlights. So there's this was the first time when they had the swiveling headlights. So as you turn the wheel, the light would point around the corner. And again, I remember seeing that on the spec sheet when they were launched. Going, that's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, that blind spot, isn't there? On the rural roads, when you go around, there's that dark patch, isn't there? When the headlights...
Not with these.
No, they just fantastic.
Turn, but then also you've got the little bit that comes on below as well when you're parking.
Yeah, the sort of... Yeah.
So the little sort of parking light that then illuminates the space as you're turning into it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's brilliant. So many good things on it. That was a proper groundbreaking car, that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Really, really cool.
So you quite like your older Land Rovers then, really, because you haven't got like a brand new Range Rover sitting at home then.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I had a period where I was on, so I'm a supplier at JLR, so they do a scheme where you can actually get a discounted lease rate when you're a supplier, and I was on that supplier scheme for a long time. From basically, I had a Discovery 3 when it was new. In fact, there's an LRM article that I did back in the day where I actually photographed that car being built.
Oh, wow.
So I went to Solihull when that car was being built. So it was my car, and I actually went and photographed it from a chassis, all the body coming on, all the assembly. So basically followed it from start to finish on the production line. It was a really, really fascinating thing. And then obviously then drove that car for 9 months. And then the way the lease worked is you got a new car every 9 months.
Wow.
So I had a period of cars where it was Range Rover Sports, Discovery 3s, Discovery 4s. That was all the way up until COVID in 2020 when I had a Range Rover Sport.
I remember that car.
Silver one it was.
Yeah, silver supercharged.
That's right, it was. Yeah. Yeah.
I went to the G4 anniversary near Milton Keynes.
Right.
And you were in it.
Along. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. You were shooting in it. And I just remember, because it was a real murky, like, wet day, and you parked on the grass, and I thought, God, that car looks good.
Yeah, it was bright silver. It was a nice car. Yeah. But so then COVID hit, and basically I was paying quite a lot of money per month for the car, and I obviously wasn't doing anything with it. So I stopped the lease, and I haven't taken it back up. So I just sort of ended up with, just by default, having the Discovery, because I wanted basically a cheap car, because obviously, again, it was just as COVID was, we were sort of starting to get through the other end of that. So I was like, well, I don't want to spend too much on a car.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I love driving it.
They are
it's
brilliant.
Like, I've ended up keeping it by default.
And of course, now you've added the Borrego Yellow Freelander.
That's it. So in fact, what it is, so the money that I would have been spending on new cars, I'm now buying old crap cars. It's great.
And making them good.
So I've got an Audi A2 as well. I think we talked about that earlier. I've got an Audi A2, which is fuel consumption. That does about sort of 55 to the gallon. So I use that quite a lot if I'm just doing a run where I don't need to carry lots of stuff, because it's a small car.
They're quite an iconic design.
They're a mega, really, almost to the same sort of level as the Disco 3.
Absolutely.
Like, technologically.
Iconic designs.
All aluminium shell, super lightweight. Yours has got the 3-cylinder diesel.
Correct.
Which is the legendary PD 1.9 with a cylinder cut off, I learned the other day. And yeah, just they were like a masterclass in aerodynamics and... Really cool.
To me, very similar to Discovery 3, a masterpiece in design, and again, similar sort of shape, very sort of tall, square, a little bit of a TARDIS inside. It's a cracking car. It only weighs, I think it's 985 kilos.
Mm.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's easy. No, that's right. It's a lightweight thing. And in fact, if you have more than two people in the car with you, you actually feel the car drive differently because of the extra weight. So
they have the little, they don't have a bonnet, a traditional
correct,
bonnet, do they?
That's
the
right.
little pop-up grill.
Drop-down thing that you basically can check the oil, do your water and your oil. So your screen wash and your oil.
All for the slickery.
I remember the last time I've seen one of those on the road, you know.
There's not many about
now. There's not many about now. No, there's sort of, I think a lot of them, because they're quite expensive to repair if you have an accident. So generally speaking, if there's any accident, they get written off because it's quite a complicated aluminium body structure. And also, I think they just got to the point where, you know, as usual, things don't get looked after. So things break, they're too expensive to repair. I mean, I paid £1,800 for mine. So, you know, and if you've got a major repair, that could be quite easily £1,000. And then it's all of a sudden the car's not economic to repair and it just gets scrapped.
When they were brand new, I remember my mate's mum had one when I was growing up, and it was almost as rare to see one back then as it is now, because for their size, they were very expensive compared to the competition. There was like a period, wasn't there, of very premium hatchbacks, even like when the new Mini came along. And do you remember the Aston Martin Signet?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That you could only buy if you were an Aston Martin customer, I believe. Yeah. They were £30,000 for a hatchback. It was a Toyota IQ.
That's right, yeah.
Real high-end interior and Aston Martin badges.
I was working with Aston Martin at that point, actually, and so I did quite a bit of photography with them.
Really?
Yeah, so...
they're a really odd thing.
They were, but they were... I mean, again, the idea was supposed to be the... If you like, the sort of the tender to the super yacht. So the idea is if you lived in London, you could have your Aston Martin Vanquish that you'd take out and enjoy in the country roads. But if you lived in town and you wanted just a little commuter car, well, you had the same colour and the same spec as your Aston Martin Vanquish, but in this small Signet. And then that was what you could sort of, you know, just gently go around the city and park easily without curbing your wheels and all the sort of stuff.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And of course, it did help bring down the CO2 average for the brand, which I'm sure was not, was definitely considered when they brought
that. They're a rare thing now. There's not many Signets around.
No. So, listening
future,
to the
future collector's item.
UK's number one premium hatchback.
Exactly. Digressing slightly. But there was, just as a real...
Could be worse. Could be talking about Yorkshire puddings.
Yeah.
But there was a V8. There was someone did a V8 Signet. They actually put the V8 from the Aston Vantage
in the back.
In the back of a Signet. Yeah, that's right. Which was a mega, pretty awesome bit of kit. Anyway, but yes, coming back to what we were saying before. So, as well as that, I also have I have TW as well, of course, my Freelander. But I also, I'm a bit of a sucker for Range Rover Classics.
You have a beautiful Range Rover.
Yes, I have a couple of. Well, I'm working on a third at the moment, but I have. Yeah, nice 1978 two-door that I bought in 2013. And in fact, that is being featured in a future issue of...
Well, Nick, this
is a nice segue. Another
perfect segue. By the time you listen to this, the day this podcast comes out, the latest issue of Land Rover Monthly will be on sale, featuring not only your beautiful Suffolk F, but another car, which is it rolled off the production line.
The same day. It's an amazing story. I almost can't believe that it happened. But my Range Rover is very pampered. It was a car that was bought brand new by a gentleman that used it pretty much just for towing his caravan. So sadly, he died in 2011, and it passed to his son, who then ultimately sold it on. But in that time, it had done 42,000 miles. So virtually no miles over that time. But he was, coming back to what we're saying, very fastidious man. He kept all his every oil change, every element of things, that the work that was done to the vehicle, in a little book, all handwritten by him.
Wow.
All the receipts. I've got the receipt for the overdrive when it was fitted, or the radio when it was fitted. So yeah, lovely car in that respect.
Proper survivor.
Yeah, that's it. And you think, gosh, this is an absolutely unique vehicle. There can't be another one like this. But strangely enough, I was at an event and met up with a chap called Richard Hughes in his white Suffolk F Range Rover, same age. And then obviously we got chatting and comparing notes. And his car, I think, had done 33,000 miles, so it was even lower mileage than mine. Same story, one owner from new, used sparingly just for sort of Sunday best, if you like.
Well,
so we were chatting away, and obviously we just looked under the bonnet, and I was like, that chassis number looks quite similar to mine. So I looked at the chassis number and then looked at mine, and they're seven numbers apart.
That's so mad, isn't it?
So those two cars were built on the same day at Solihull. in March 1978, so almost sort of 38 years to the day. And yeah, there they are, basically surviving as, you know, pristine, low mileage, all original cars. Both cars have got their original body panels, you know, original rear top and bottom rear tailgates, which is almost heard of on Range Rovers because they normally rust away. But yeah, and they were built on the same day at Solihull. So, yeah, I just was intrigued, and I say we haven't managed to find out yet, but I'm intrigued to know what happened to the six cars that were in between. Where are they? What are they doing now?
Well, yeah. If you grab the latest issue of LRM, have a look at the feature. It's absolutely brilliant. We've called it Mirror Image, and the opening shot is fantastic. It's the two cars like nose to nose on the opening spread. And if you know of the whereabouts of the vehicles that were produced between these two beautiful white Range Rovers, then drop us an email.
It'd be amazing to find out, wouldn't it? What a thing to actually see if those cars still exist.
Absolutely. Yeah. editorial@lrm.co.uk. Let us know if you might be able to sniff one out. But yeah, don't miss that. Don't miss that issue. It goes on sale today in shops. Subscribers should already have their copy. And of course, they would have saved money because they subscribe, which makes sense.
It just certainly does.
Anyway, yeah. Nick, yeah. Sorry, I went off your marketing tangent.
That's no problem at all. Well, that's it. So that's that Range Rover, which again, I feel very fortunate to be able to have purchased. I had no intention of buying it. It was offered to me by a friend, Nick Rogers. Yeah, he basically was selling it to buy a Suffolk A, and I couldn't really afford to buy it at the time, but I drove it and I was like, I can't afford not to buy it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, managed to sort of borrow a bit of money, and you know, that was it. I took delivery of it, which I'm glad I did. You know, I couldn't afford to buy it now because it's probably worth way more than I bought paid for it.
But a good investment.
But I got a great investment, exactly. So that's good. And then, two other Range Rovers. I've got a 1995 Autobiography, which I bought in 2009.
Right.
So again, you know, that was a car that was low mileage. It was 80,000 miles.
Wow.
It was 70,000 miles when I got it. It's now just over 80,000. So I've not exactly used it a lot, but I do have used it every now and again. But again, unusual car in the sense that it was a 4.2 V8 factory fitted on the standard 100-inch wheelbase. Only 26 were built like that to basically launch the Autobiography program. So it's a light stone leather interior, British Racing green paint. It actually came with the Range Rover body kit, which I changed when I did a light restoration of it back in 2009, 2010.
Right.
Which again was actually featured in Land Rover Monthly back in the day. So wow. If you, I don't think you can get back issues that far back online here with you guys.
2009.
Yeah, that's probably.
But if you have,
on eBay and stuff, there might be a few copies knocking around.
That's the best place to find them these days. Because if we happen upon any from that sort of era, tough, I'm taking them home. So, but no, eBay. If you know what issue you're after, have a skip.
There was a little feature about that being redone, and then as a car that is actually in the process of being redone at the moment. So I've got a 1995 Vogue SE that I bought in 2005.
Wow.
So I ran it as my daily driver for about 9 months, and then parked it up. And it's one of those things that I parked it up not really sort of planning anything for it, just sort of parked it up and thought, well, I don't really want to sell it. And it was sat in my storage at home, which is fortunately undercover. So it's been undercover for, basically the last 20 years.
Wow.
And I took it out. It's the car's 30th birthday in August 2025. And I decided that it was time that it had a bit of a refresh. So so it's currently actually at 2010.
Aha.
Where it's being sort of, it's not having a completely full body off rebuild, largely it doesn't actually need it, which is incredible when you think about it. But it's because it was parked up in 2005 when it was 10 years old.
Yeah,
it's been sat undercover for the last 20 years. So even though the car's 30 years old, it's actually only had 10 years worth of use.
Okay.
So it's actually not as rusty. It's a little bit rusty, but it's not as rusty as you might expect.
That's good going.
For a 30-year-old Range Rover.
Isn't it mad to think that in 2005 that was only 10 years old?
Isn't it crazy?
But that 20 years goes in just in a flash, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
You know, when you're busy and you're working and...
That's it. It has been a car that's obviously, yeah. I've been busy working and it's just been sat there sort of, you know, gathering dust. And my wife's been like, what are you doing with that Range Rover? So finally I was like, right, we're going to do something with that Range Rover. So, so it's in the process of being redone. It's now, it's been resprayed. It's had all the rust been sorted, all been basically the lower half of the car has been pretty much rebuilt.
Right.
Those guys do an amazing job with basically reconstruction of the body frame. The next thing is I'm going to go for and you've got a bit of a theme here, cloth interior and manual gearbox.
Very good.
So it's, even though it was an auto 3.9 auto with leather,
right,
as a Vogue SE, I'm actually retrofitting an R380 manual 5-speed and cloth seats.
Very cool. The V8 with that R380 box is a lovely combination.
It is.
A friend had a 4-liter, they call them a 4-liter, but the same capacity P38.
Yes.
With that manual box, and do you know what? I've it's a completely different dynamic.
It is very much very
it really
different.
Changes the vehicle completely.
That should be ready, hopefully, sort of back end of this year, I think.
You know your 4x4. You've chosen every upgrade, every bolt-on with purpose. So when it comes to tyres, chunkier, wider, more capable for the conditions, you want the perfect fit. Not just any tyre, your tyre. That's why you'll choose 4x4tyres.co.uk, the wheel and tyre specialists, trusted by Land Rover owners and serious off-roaders alike. Whether you're upsizing, overlanding, making your Defender look the part, or your Discovery turn heads, we'll guide you to the right set. With over 800 fitting locations across the UK, from online to on-road, we've got you covered. Browse by vehicle, wheel size or brand. 4x4tyres.co.uk. The right fit, the right place, the right price.
So
give us a shout when it's done.
Do you have any plans for trips with it, is there any reason to get it done?
That's a good question, actually. No, I think I think we'll take it and do trips in the UK, but yeah, we may go further afield, as you know, as demonstrated by Freeland.
Yeah. Harriers are calling.
Exactly, that's it.
Yeah.
Wow. Really? We'll see. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
It's what, I mean, I'm a passionate Range Rover, Land Rover fan, have been since I was a kid, and it's one of those things that, you know, it's indulging my passion. It's that thing where back in the day, you know, you wanted a Range Rover but you couldn't afford one, so you know, I've managed to squirrel one away that was quite cheap when I bought it. I think I paid about £5,000 for it in 2005.
Not big money to have to have tied up, really,
no,
is it?
It was 120,000 miles when I bought it. I think I did like 7,000 or 8,000 in the year that I had it, and then it's been sort of parked up ever since and just waiting to get
maturing.
Done. Maturing, exactly.
Like a fine wine.
Yeah. We've created your own sort of barn find.
Fine.
Exactly.
It's like, look, I've got a totally forgotten about that.
Wow. So that's that. So I think the autobiography might have to go just to sort of make a bit of space for that once it's back in regular use. So if anyone wants an autobiography, let me know.
I was going to say they were a rare machine when they were new.
Yeah.
Even rarer machine now.
Yeah, not many about, that's for sure.
Must be nice just to own things for a few years and to really, because I, you know, I've my
Land Rover. You've owned your 90 a good few years.
Yeah, the one in the garage, you mean?
Yeah,
all right. You haven't mentioned that for a few weeks.
Well, I thought I'd better shoehorn and dig it.
Leave me be.
It has been a while. It
has been a while. But just to get like a car that you own inside you know it inside and out, and to kind of build that long term.
Yeah.
I've never done that.
I've never been very good at
it. Changed so many times that I haven't.
Yeah, I'm very bad at. Speak to my wife, she says I'm very bad at selling cars. That's the problem. very bad.
We spoke about this earlier, didn't we? In the office, you know, space and time.
It is, yeah.
And if you've got the space, if I had the space, I would fit it and I wouldn't sell anything.
Well, I'm very fortunate. I actually rent a lockup, basically, a unit. So that has enough space for basically five cars. So
it's a decent size.
Is
it maxed out?
It is maxed out. So I can't. There's no room. There's no room at the inn. No.
So everyone's there now with like a really rare sort of cloth interior.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one in, one out now.
Okay.
That's how it's going to work. So
fair enough. Yeah. Well, one a question that I, for some reason, want to ask you is, what's your take on the P38?
Okay, that's an interesting one. Because at the time, I remember when it was first launched, I didn't like it at all.
Right.
But, as you say, like a fine wine, I feel it has matured. And, I've never lived with one. I've never owned one.
Okay.
I do remember, I mean, when I was first starting with Land Rover, obviously it was late 90s, so they were still in production. So did a few photo shoots with the cars and had them to use for, you know, sort of 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And I remember them being a really nice place to be, particularly the V8, real sort of wafting, that had a really nice, rich sound, doesn't it, that V8?
Yeah, definitely.
It's quite a unique, very sort of quite grand, isn't it? Sort of quite a grand car. So I've never owned one. I'd sort of like to own one, but again, saying this, in one in, one out sort of thing.
Yeah, difficult.
The phone ringing now with somebody with a cloth interior one manual. He's going, actually,
they do.
I've got enough cars that take my attention. So it would have to be something would have to go in order to get one. But I've occasionally sort of seen one. Where I'm like, ooh,
I wasn't. Nice.
But I think in the past I've always bought cars that haven't been too expensive. And I think now I don't know whether have they got to the point where they're.
They do still come up. The thing is,
you need to get. I'd like to get one that doesn't need too much work.
Yeah,
to it. And of course, that's the problem. Is you could be buying a lot of
pain.
A lot of pain.
Yeah. My interest had peaked a while ago, and then it dropped off, and it had been in the background for a while, and then it was peaked again very recently when one got listed on LRM Marketplace. You know what I'm on about.
I saw it and almost shared it with you.
Yeah.
You wafted a day.
Yes.
I didn't.
So what car was this? What is this?
You're interested in that, aren't you?
It's still on there.
I would be very shocked if it hasn't sold already. Let me quickly have a look.
Might still be on the website, but they may have sold it.
It's a 2001 build, but okay. 02 registered. So okay. One of the last.
And of course, that's a good year because, of course, most of the...
All of the problems.
All the teething problems.
No, not all of them.
Well,
some of.
The majority of them have been ironed out.
But then they've now had a chance to reappear.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll be
the fullness of time.
There'll be problems with it, but it's a really nice thing and fairly local to us. It's still on the website, whether it's still for sale or not by the time this goes
live. They are good-looking things with those nice wheels.
This has got the 18-inch Comets, which are the ones to have, if you ask me. If you don't like Hurricanes, 135,000 miles. Vogue SE 4.6, running with MOT until April, so not a huge long MOT, but still on air.
Yeah.
Never been on LPG, which is a bonus.
Yeah, definitely.
Epsom green, five alloys.
Looks nice, nicely standard, not been messed with.
It's got the annoying sat nav, which never worked when it was new and probably doesn't now.
But again, what a thing at the time.
Yeah, true. Droopy headliner, paint isn't perfect. Comes with some spares, some service history.
£2,000.
Tempting, isn't it?
When I saw that come up, because we approve all the classifiers.
I mean, literally, that is purely a space thing, because I could quite happily buy that.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's cheapest chips, isn't it? But £2,000. What can you get for £2,000?
If I had the space, I'm in.
Yeah, this is
but
it.
If I had the space, that's the thing. So
what we'll do, we'll make an offer on TW now. Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, it's just an old Range Rover, isn't it?
It is, that's right. Yes,
it's not worth a great deal. Then you go and buy that.
Hopefully, if it hasn't sold and if none of us three have been gone and rung this chap up and gone.
It definitely will not
hit
be
the tyres.
I'm maxed out.
That's the problem. It's space, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love it, but
it looks like a lovely thing,
doesn't it? Anyway, that's enough of that. Thank you. I know I've banged on about it already. Go out and buy the latest issue. It's on sale today. It's got a cracking feature in it from Nick Dimbleby about his Range Rover Suffolk F, and of course the car that came off the production line on the same day. Cracking story. Loads of other brilliant Land Rover content, including we talk about TEW, which is a hybrid, a modern take on a hybrid.
Okay,
a chap who's got a late 80s, 90, and he's essentially integrated all the tech from a Disco 2 into it. So
okay.
TD5 engine, air suspension, climate control. Mm-hmm. He's done a lovely job on it. It's really, really cool.
Aha, yes, I remember now.
Yes.
This one's on the cover.
Yes, you do. Of course you do, Steve.
And
come on.
This is the thing I was saying before. What I love about that sort of era of Land Rover is the fact you could interchange so many bits. You know, the fact you could put air suspension on a Defender, a classic Defender.
Amazing, really.
Great, really, isn't it? You know, just sort of, retrofit a TD5.
What I love about all of this, even now, is that in the nation, around the world, there's people in sheds with ideas, and they're cracking on and doing it, and they're creating their dream Land Rover.
Definitely.
And it's happening as we speak.
In fact, if you've done that very thing and you think you've created the pinnacle of what you think is your ideal Land Rover, do drop me an email, because we're always on the lookout for cool Land Rovers and cool stories. So editorial@lrm.co.uk. I'd love to see it. And if it goes no further, it goes no further. But I genuinely do love to see people's interpretation of their perfect Land Rover. So get in touch.
I think we should have some more P38 love in the magazine.
That's a good shout.
I've got a possible feature for you actually on that, in that score. So
we'll talk later.
If anyone that wants P38 content, then subscribe to LRM. Make sure it falls on in your letterbox.
Yeah. So another itch I'd like to scratch talking about that, you reminded me. So I've got a little project that I'm definitely going to do in the future, which is a TDV8 Discovery 3/4.
Okay. Yes, I definitely see the appeal.
So that's definitely an itch I want to
scratch. That's probably the pinnacle of that car type, isn't it? Rather than Defender.
Well, they never made it, of course.
No.
But of course, it was a Range Rover Sport. Pretty much the L320 at Range Rover Sport is the same front end. So yeah. It should. I mean, I know it has been done.
It's fairly well documented now. It's a great thing, and that ultimate discovery.
Yeah, so that's my sort of on my bucket list.
So what's going to be sold?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, it did say the autobiography might go.
Yeah,
but that's got to make room for the one that's at 2010.
That's true.
TDW
needs to find a new home.
Steve's going to be going down the bank with his tail between.
Or I need a bigger lockup.
Yeah. Well, there is that problem.
There is that. Yeah. As long as it's not the Freelander.
No, Freelander's staying. When you've done a little trip like that, you've got to.
Oh, definitely.
It's part of the family now.
Good. Good stuff. Well, I think, we're over an hour already, but thank you ever so much for listening. Go out and buy the magazine. Check out Land Rover Monthly on Instagram, Facebook. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, for crying out loud. And sign up to our email newsletters, because we actually deliver relevant content that you'll want to see. We don't bombard you with spam, because that would be stupid. Steve Miller Automotive on Instagram. I'm Land Rover Martin. Nick Dimbleby is Nick Dimbleby.
There's only one Nick Dimbleby.
Nick Dimbleby. As always, we love to get your feedback. We'd love to get your questions. editorial@lrm.co.uk. And leave us a little rating, if you would, on your preferred streaming platform, because it all helps justify our existence. So, as always, thank you ever so much for listening. Thank you, Nick, once again, for making the trip
over. Thank you for having me.
To take in the beautiful sound sofa and chat to us for a couple of hours. We really appreciate it. And we will see you next week.
Bye for now.
Cheerio.